welcome you all to our courtroom today, but a special welcome to students from O'Keefe Middle School. I think this is the third or fourth group we've had from this middle school in the last 2 days. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with a national award-winning program that's sponsored by the Supreme Court in the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to come and listen to an oral argument. They're given materials about the case they will hear, and they meet at noon with a justice of this court. And the discussion, and everybody's invited. You don't have to be a student from O'Keefe or any other school. The discussion after this case will be on the procedures of the court in taking cases, deciding cases, and issuing opinions. The discussion is not on the substantive issues, legal issues involved in the case. Would anyone like a summary of this case? The marshal has summaries. If you'd raise your right hand, or your left hand, if you prefer, we'll give you a summary. Okay. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I'm the justice assigned to meet with the students today. That's very fortunate for me and extremely fortunate for you all. Let me introduce the court. On the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I've introduced myself. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robensack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With the introductions made, I will call our second case for this morning. And it's 13AP2707, Milwaukee City Housing Authority versus Felton Cobb. Representing the City of Milwaukee is Assistant City Attorney Mr. Heinen, and representing Felton Cobb is Legal Action of Wisconsin Jeffrey R. Meyer, Attorney Meyer. Mr. Heinen, you have 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal, and Mr. Meyer, you have 30 minutes. So we shall proceed. Mr. Heinen.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Assistant City Attorney John Heinen, counsel for the petitioner, the Housing Authority of the City of Milwaukee. The legal issue in this case is preemption. Specifically, this court must determine whether Wisconsin Statute 704.17 sub 2 sub b stands as an obstacle to the accomplishment and execution of the full purposes and objectives of Congress. That's a quote from the Hines v. Davidovitz case, 1941 U.S. Supreme Court case, which effectively set out the third level or third type of preemption. In this case, the congressional purpose and objective is to give public housing authorities the tools to combat crime in public housing by enacting regulations that implement a one-strike-and-you're-out policy in all federally subsidized housing programs, including public housing, the type occupied by the respondent in this case, Felton Cobb. In this case, the First District Court of Appeals overlooked the regulatory scheme enacted by Congress to implement the one-strike policy, stating that the policy derived from an agency manual and so was not entitled to the deference given federal regulations with the force of law. That's at paragraph 11 of the Court of Appeals decision. Yet, as argued both by the Housing Authority and the Housing and Development Law Institute, HDLI, one of your amicus briefs, One strike is significantly more than the pamphlet which was appended to the respondent's brief in the Court of Appeals. As detailed in HDLI's amicus, the regulatory scheme is extensive. In fact, comprehensive is the term that they use in their brief. It was created by three separate acts of Congress to address the needs in a laundry list of HUD-funded housing programs, including public housing and the Section 8 rent assistance program. The regulations are many and detailed. The issues addressed in the regulations include the ability to better screen program applicants, to deny occupancy for illegal drug users, for alcohol abusers, for methamphetamine producers, to deny access by registered sex offenders, and fleeing felons. The regulations allow for termination of assistance to these same categories if they are occupants by being already tenants or participants in the rent assistance program. It also allows for the revision of form leases to provide notice of these enhanced measures in order to safeguard public housing residents. In short,
Council,
it's to provide low-income... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What exact language are we talking about in the U.S. Code? Is this discussion about evicting tenants due to drug-related criminal activity, or just what is the exact language?
The exact language is found at 42 United States Code, Section 1437, small d, sub small l, small, or let the number 6.
I got that. What's the wording?
The language is that public housing authorities shall have leases that provide any drug-related criminal activity on or off the premises,
okay,
engaged in by public housing tenants or members of their household, guests, or persons under their control shall be cause for termination of tenancy.
Okay. Now, was Mr. Cobb ever charged with a drug-related activity?
No, Your Honor.
No. Not charged. Was he ever brought before the police?
No, he was not.
The facts are that private security guard.
Correct.
Smelled marijuana, right?
That's correct.
And smelling marijuana in the car or smelling it in the house or whatever can be, what, reasonable suspicion?
Yes, Your Honor. According to your Sechrist and Hughes decisions,
right,
it can constitute probable cause.
Well, I started out lower than that on reasonable suspicion. Then we got to probable cause. But probable cause is not a crime, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. So how do you get to being under 1437 D16 of having drug-related criminal activity when there was no charge? There's no police report filed, right? No investigation other than this security person, right?
That's correct.
And at the time of this, quote, activity, did Milwaukee County have a forfeiture law for a civil law for marijuana?
Small amounts, although there's enhancements for amounts that are found in or around within 1,000 feet, in fact, of public housing authorities.
Mm-hmm. So could this have been charged as a forfeiture, a civil offense?
It could have.
So now you got him with a civil offense or a criminal activity, depending on what the DA did, right?
Yes.
But it never even got that far to the DA. It never got to the police department.
Yeah,
right?
It was a completed act by the time the public safety officer arrived.
So you think that's enough under the federal statute?
I do, Your Honor. And I think that that's the case because the federal statute goes on to say in another section of the one-strike criteria that neither an arrest nor a conviction is necessary for the illegal activity to be found. It doesn't say that a crime has to be committed. It talks about the criminal activity and the drug-related activity, not a drug crime, drug-related activity. effectively in order to allow public housing authorities to exercise the discretion which the regulations essentially require them to do. They spell out in great detail the kinds of discretionary calls that they want public housing authorities to make. There is no requirement that there be law enforcement involvement.
So what are the rights of the tenant?
The tenants are living in public housing. That's housing that's owned by the government, and the government has the right to make the determination as to what their terms and conditions will be. This tenant, as all public housing tenants, signed a lease agreeing to the terms and conditions, including that he would not consume illegal drugs.
And I thought that the lease also contained reference to the Wisconsin statutes, which is a 5-day notice statute.
It does, with an exceptions clause.
Okay, what's the exception clause?
The exception is that where drug-related and criminal activity is involved, that the time that will be involved will be discretionary with the housing authority. They will determine what type of notice will be issued in those cases.
So it's not an absolute bar to the five. Everything is discretionary.
Correct.
No limits on the federal government at all.
No, I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. There certainly are.
I wouldn't say that either. What would you say?
I would say that there are landlord-tenant statutes that do indeed complement and work with the federal regulations and are intended to. This is not, at least the parties have not argued here, that this is a case of field preemption, although there is a judge in Kentucky specifically who believes it is. Nonetheless, the landlord-tenant statutes will still afford tenants the rights that they are entitled to, but if those rights conflict directly with the federal regulation which says that the housing authority shall be the final determinant of whether or not a lease violation has occurred, and a court will ultimately decide whether the facts have been met, then it has to succumb, if you will, or in our opinion, it's trumped or preempted by the federal regulation.
Mr. Einan, how does the Scarborough decision enter into all of this from your point of view?
It's almost an identical set of facts insofar as this is also a case where there was a crime that was allegedly committed. In that case, it was a loaded weapons found in the unit. Again, violation of the lease. There's no indication as to whether or not that defendant was ever charged with any crimes. That's not what's pertinent. What's pertinent is that it was a violation of her lease. Just as with Wisconsin, the District of Columbia allows for a right to cure on a first-time lease violation. In that case, the only difference being in that case, they give a 30-day right to cure. Wisconsin, we have an at least 5-day right, which isn't set in stone. It's, again, discretionary with the landlord how long of a period of time they'll afford the tenant to either move or cure.
Counselor, how do you cure a past law violation?
That is a central question that, unfortunately, the parties have not briefed, but that I would encourage this Court, and I would point out that the Apartment Association of Southeast Wisconsin, in its amicus brief, is asking this Court to look at that question. How do you cure a crime? What the government has decided is that because it can't be cured, it's incurable. It's not like an ongoing lease violation. And that discussion is also had in the Scarborough decision, that in fact, when a crime's committed, the public housing authority has to then exercise the discretion as to whether or not it's serious enough in nature, whether it was committed by the leaseholder or a member of the family, which, of course, is also a lease violation, but is to be taken into consideration, and the extent to which that type of criminal behavior is a problem for the housing authority.
Counsel, we just heard oral argument on a case that perhaps involved a situation that someone had a controlled substance, which would be, I assume, under your definition, illegal drug activity, possessing a controlled substance without a prescription. And then purportedly that person went after confronted with this issue and got a prescription from her doctor. Would that be tantamount to curing a violation?
I would consider that to be a sort of mitigating circumstance that the public housing authority ought to take under consideration. What's difficult in this case is that this respondent simply denied.
Yes.
He said, I didn't do it.
My question is a bit more focused, not necessarily on this case, but on my hypothetical. We raised the question, well, how do you cure a past criminal activity? And I'm asking if that would be an example of someone possessing oxycodone, a controlled substance without a prescription. And then when confronted with, hey, you have this and there's no prescription, immediately going to their doctor and having their doctor write the prescription for it. Would that be tantamount to curing a past criminal activity?
I don't view it as a cure, Judge. I guess, to be frank with you, the way if that call had to be made...
Tell me why not, because it sounds to me like a bit of a cure.
Well, it does. It falls within the area of trying to take some action, some remedy, right? And that's the language that's in the statute, that a tenant shall have the right to remedy. They don't even use the word cure. But I can tell you that the circuit courts are interpreting that right to remedy phrase as consistent with what is it to cure? What does it mean to cure? I have argued to two circuit courts in the last 2 months that this statute, 70417, clearly implicates the fact that there will be some kind of action taken by the tenant. An attempt to right the wrong, attempt to redress the breach, the lease violation. In fact, there's even an example in the statute that if damages are appropriate to cure the lease violation, that there will be a bona fide, reasonable offer to pay damages. The circuit courts have not viewed it that way. They've, in fact, relied on a 2010 decision of Justice Abrahamson, the Volvo truck of North America versus the State Department of Transportation case, in which the interpretation of cure was found to be essentially that you cease and desist the conduct, that you simply do not repeat the violation. Now, that context is in the motor vehicle dealer's laws in Chapter 218, a completely commercial transaction. I think that it's not the appropriate interpretation of what constitutes a cure in a landlord-tenant relationship.
Well, let's take landlord-tenant and suppose I had a pet, and that's okay under the rules, okay? But the pet does something that's not okay under the rules. It uses the regular elevator instead of the freight elevator. Let's say that's the rule in the housing authority. So they get this border collie on... violation of which elevator that the collie uses. And then the housing authority wants to get rid of the tenant on that basis. That's a civil offense, if it's any offense under the law, but it's a violation of the rules. How do you cure that? You don't pay the housing authority a fine or a forfeiture. You don't pay them damages. All you can say is, I will cease and desist. I'll never let that dog into the human elevators, only the freight elevator.
Well, that certainly is an approach that has been taken by tenants to suggest that they simply...
And the circuit courts, apparently.
Yeah, the circuit courts are willing to accept that the decision not to repeat the conduct is sufficient. And what that effectively does is it takes the discretion away from the landlord and it vests it with the tenant.
Well, but that's because there are very few entities or people in the world, or I should just say in our country, that have unfettered discretion not reviewable by anyone else. And that includes federal housing authorities, too.
And I don't suggest that there's no room for court review of the decisions made by the housing authority.
But do you want this court to say that the remedy here has to be damages, or that somehow the past is righted, and that cease and desist, on, even under civil matters, is required? Is that what the rule is you want this court to bring that forth?
I think that to simply cease and desist does not undo the harm that's done by the initial lease violation.
And so it doesn't matter whether it's criminal or civil or rule violation. Cease and desist is not good enough.
It's not. It does not undo the lease violation.
It doesn't undo it. Somehow you got to go back and undo it.
Or the circumstances that surrounded the initial lease violation need to be reviewed. Any mitigating circumstances need to be taken into consideration. That's precisely what the regulation speaks to and what the housing authority must do. That sort of exercise of discretion is what the Court of Appeals found was not sufficient to allow for preemption, even though that's what the regulations are calling for.
You know, we have to be careful at what stage we're talking about. it's your position that preemption means, if I hear you right, preemption means that cease and desist is not good enough under the federal law.
I don't know that it means that, Judge, because as I say, we have not actually briefed the question of what it means to cure a lease violation. What I have argued in brief is that the preemption applies in a case where the regulations clearly indicate who's to exercise the discretion, and we're up against a state statute that allows not just one opportunity to cure, but arguably a second opportunity. In my brief, I use the pet example as one in which if it were simply a lease violation to have the pet, and you agreed to get rid of the pet in response to your first lease violation, that was your cure. Okay?
It was a cease and desist.
A cease and desist.
Right.
Yet then again, you're found later to, report has it, Justice Abrahamson has her pet back. Now, then a second lease violation could issue, and under the terms of the statute, a second lease violation within a year from the first, after being given, the tenant again commits a breach other than payment of rent. The tenancy is terminated if the landlord, prior to the tenant remedying the waste or breach. So you would be free to then say, well, I have forgotten. I've, in fact, now gotten rid of my cat a second time. Before I was served with the notice, I got rid of the cat. You can come and see. The cat's no longer in my home. That sort of prevention of a federal objective is what we're dealing with and what we're asking the court to rule ought to be preempted.
Aren't you discussing drug-related activity, not having a border collie? I mean, I wonder if you're getting a little far from the issue here.
Well,
I thought you were relying on the statute and the federal preemption that involved federal-funded housing doesn't need to house people who are using drugs, drug-related criminal activity. And I thought that was your point, not whether or not a border collie is using the wrong elevator.
Yeah, what I was attempting to do is walk into a situation where there is a curable lease violation, like housing a pet. The situation in this case where you have a crime. There's even a more compelling argument to be made for the fact that the regulations make it mandatory that if there's a tenant who's engaged in the production or manufacture of methamphetamines, they must be evicted. They must, under the federal regulation, not in Wisconsin. We could not.
Mr. Heinen, instead of focusing any longer on the cure idea, maybe you could assist us in terms of the preemption issue. As I view the case law in Wisconsin, as I view the case law nationally, there is usually a tendency on the part of local government to find a way around preemption. What will assist us here in deciding whether or not there really is a preemption situation?
I would encourage the court to look at the impossibility scenario that I just painted of the methamphetamine producer who cannot be evicted, that level of preemption, in fact, goes beyond what we've even argued in this case, which was the conflict or frustration of purpose preemption. You know, of the three levels, we clearly do not have an express preemption clause here that we can point to, nor do we arguably have the field preemption, although, again, as you will note in the case that I suspect my opponent to cite, the Coventry versus Turner case out of Kentucky, in the concurring opinion of Judge Moore in that case, he is of the opinion that, in fact, the field of criminal offenses committed in public housing is indeed a recognizable field, and that it is, in fact, preempted. However, he joins the majority in that case, and for reasons that I don't think I need to get into. But the field of preemption is one that has some fluidity to it. And the case of the U.S. v. English points to the fact that there is indeed some morphing of the different scenarios that will fall within. What exactly does it constitute to be in conflict? Just about any case that comes before this court is dealing with a conflict between two policies or a conflict between two laws. Here you have a regulation that's, I would submit, in direct conflict with a state statute. And so I would submit.
You know, one thing you never argue is that maybe this state statute doesn't apply at all to criminal conduct. I mean, I personally don't see how you can cure past criminal conduct. So instead of smoke and dope, maybe this guy's running a house of prostitution out of his apartment. And so there's proof provided to that. And he says, okay, I'm going to quit. I won't do it again. Even if he never does it again, there's no way of remedying what was done before. And the statute speaks to a remedy.
Right.
So if you got a statute that speaks to a remedy, and you got conduct that's not remedied by whatever you're doing in the future, I wonder why you're not arguing that 974.17.2b simply does not apply to criminal conduct. Period. Forget the preemption. The statute doesn't apply in the first instance.
Yeah, the argument is the response I can make is that when it comes to the interplay between the regulation and the landlord-tenant laws and the variety of conduct, since we don't have a case where it's only crimes that are subject to arrest, subject to charge, potential conviction.
Well, you're back and looking at the federal statute. I'm putting blinders on, and I'm only looking at the Wisconsin statute. And you seem to concede that it applies to everything. Any kind of conduct, you have a right to remedy. And so you look to the federal law and say, but under federal law you don't, and federal law preempts the state law. And I think preemption is a wonderfully interesting argument, and I enjoyed the briefs on it. But I kept wondering why you're not saying step number one is the statute doesn't apply to criminal conduct because you cannot remedy it.
That is what I'm attempting to argue. Perhaps it wasn't sufficiently argued in the
briefs. Well, you're saying it under your preemption arguments, but I don't think you've argued that the statute itself, just forget the federal law, this statute simply doesn't apply. Wisconsin didn't intend to give people the opportunity to make a remedy for past criminal conduct.
I don't disagree with the court.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's no statutory history because I looked. I couldn't find anything to talk about any limitation. Okay.
Mr. Hyatt.
It's
in the federal law, and I haven't ever looked at it before this case. You got lots of different instances where the housing authority can evict. You've got criminal activity. Even in criminal activity, maybe marijuana is different than methadone, as you have stated the statutes. You have civil issues, which also would be subject to eviction. Violation of the rules of the apartment would be subject to eviction. So you got all of these different provisions potentially evicting someone. So my question to you is, if we take the position that state statute doesn't apply unless you can cure, right? There's a remedy.
The state statute requires
a remedy.
Correct.
Which means cease and desist is not good enough.
I don't believe it's a sufficient remedy under these circumstances.
Well, and it might not be a sufficient remedy under methadone. It may not be a sufficient remedy under the PET. It might not be a sufficient remedy in many circumstances. What bothers me is what kind of ruling of this court is limited enough to cover this circumstance and not everything else.
Well,
do you know what I'm talking about?
I do, and I think it's in furtherance of your earlier point regarding criminal conduct.
That's right.
That's the focus here.
That's right.
Not necessarily a crime, but criminal activity.
You know, but if you say cease and desist is not enough, why doesn't that apply to the PET case?
Because cease and desist deprives the landlord of the opportunity to exercise discretion. It's no longer up to the landlord. And as the seminal case really in this area, not in the preemption area, but in the area of drug-related or criminal lease violations in public housing is U.S. v. Rucker. HUD v. Rucker is the case that I would encourage you to analyze because it's in that case that the court makes a point of saying that this is not the government acting as a sovereign. This is the government acting as a landlord of property it owns. And if it elects to have a 15-page lease versus a typical 2-page lease, it's within the government's prerogative to do so. Similarly, the range of conducts which it wants to prohibit so that it can promote healthy, safe, decent living for the vast majority of public housing residents who are not violating the lease provisions are set out in a document that is promulgated itself by HUD, by the very same organization. I see that the light is on.
Yeah, but your argument is not that all of Wisconsin landlord-tenant law is preempted by the feds for federal housing. That is not your argument.
Correct, Your Honor. Just this right to cure.
So it's much more narrow than that. Okay.
Is it right to cure in drug-related activity? I mean, is it that narrow?
Consistent with the regulation in public housing, Justice Brosnan.
Justice Brosnan.
You won in the circuit court. You lost in the Court of Appeals. But this case involves a single guy smoking marijuana. If the Court of Appeals is affirmed, what are the consequences of that?
Well, we're left with essentially a greatly diminished environment for public housing, because those, and you can fill in the blank for the scenario you would not want to have to contend with, the neighbor who committed the sexual assault of someone down the block, who could not be evicted because they said, I won't do it again. That's what's going to happen if we continue in a scenario where we cannot evict for first offense criminal activities, and where the criminal activity, that same tenant, as I've argued in my brief, could rob the office. It's not one of those narrow exceptions that was just carved out in 2013 by Act 76. There was a new statute, 70416, sub 3, that carves out a narrow group of crimes, primarily domestic abuse, for which the victim obtains an injunction, either of that the victim or and the person has to be a tenant or the child of a tenant, and they have to get an injunction or a criminal complaint has to issue. So there's a very narrow set of crimes. Drug house and criminal gang house is another set. But it doesn't cover the waterfront. And what we're dealing with is a broad category of activity that impacts your neighbors. And that's what we're trying to essentially give public housing authorities the tools to keep public housing a healthy, safe place.
If you commit domestic violence, you can stay in public housing?
So if you are if you commit it off-premise, you will get a right to cure, unless it's another tenant.
No, I'm doing it on-premises.
Now, the new law states that if it takes place to another tenant on the premises, then you would get a non-curable notice.
What about your brother-in-law comes and he's not a tenant and there's violence?
If he's not a tenant or the child of a tenant, brother-in-laws apparently are not included.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for Mr. Cobb. Mr. Meyer.
Good morning. My name is Jeffrey Meyer. I represent Felton Cobb. The preemption doctrine sets a very high bar for the housing authority to surmount. And that high bar is distilled in the sentence in paragraph 4 of Judge Fine's decision that has been overlooked so far. It's the sentence that says, in the preemption analysis, courts shall assume that the historic police powers of the state are not superseded unless that was the clear and manifest purpose of Congress. The historic police powers of the state that we are talking about in this case is the power of the state, Wisconsin's legislature, to control the court's eviction of tenants. It is one of the most fundamental, back to medieval time, powers of government.
I don't know, counsel, because In the ordinary eviction case, four out of the seven of us on this bench have served as trial court judges. I, and I assume the three others, presided over any number of evictions. I look to the lease. I look to the terms of the lease. And I'm looking at the terms of the lease that your client signed on December 3rd, 2012. And under Section 5, which is 5 is entitled Resident Obligations, and I go to 5Q, and I read as in pertinent part as follows. To assure that the resident, this is under the obligations, to assure that the resident, any member of the household, guest, or another person under resident's control shall not engage in, and then I go down to sub 2, any drug-related or violent criminal activity on or off the public housing development's property. Such activity shall be cause for termination of tenancy. And then it goes on to define drug-related criminal activity means the illegal manufacture, sale, distribution, and pertinently here, use. So, it appears to me that this lease contemplates that the definition of criminal activity will encompass a situation where there's an ordinance violation by the use of the term illegal in the definition section.
Yes, I'll concede that there's grounds for termination of the lease.
Yes.
And that, yes, that then triggers another section of the lease, Your Honor, paragraph 9C.
Well, wait a minute. Before we get to 9C, okay, let's talk about 6J. This is under the Housing Authority's obligation, and they have the obligation under 6J to endeavor to provide at least one written warning prior to a proposed termination of tenancy, except for non-payment of rent, and in the case of a violation of 5Q, which is exactly what we just discussed. Okay, now I'll go with you to 9C. Okay?
This is how the lease is terminated. 9C starts with, the HACM may evict a tenant only by bringing a court action. The HACM termination notice shall be given in accordance with a lease for 1 year per Section 704.17(2). That's how one terminates. One gives a 5-day right to cure, and then if there's another breach, a 14-day notice. That is what the contract requires.
That is one of the general terms of the contract, but it seems to me there is a very specific provision. And isn't, I'm having a conversation here. I'm trying.
Yeah,
to,
no. I appreciate it.
Isn't there a fundamental rule of law that if the specific trumps the general, and if we have a specific provision here that says, look, even if it's an ordinance violation, it's going to serve as grounds, and I'm combining, obviously, the two sections. It is mandatory that there be a termination of the tenancy. That's how I read J.
No, termination of the tenancy is not mandatory, and there is no argument made on any federal level.
But it says, well, under J, the Housing Authority must endeavor to provide at least one written warning. Okay? So that might cover the border collie hypothetical. To endeavor to provide at least one written warning prior to a proposed termination of tenancy, except for violations of 5Q. How can we read that other than to say one violation, that's the end of the story?
You get a warning. Under these circumstances, you get a warning before we get to the statutory notice to terminate. That's what it means. You get a warning that says, slip up.
Yep.
Next one, you're getting the 5-day notice.
Keep Lassie out of the elevator.
Next one, you're getting the 5-day notice. If there's another breach after that, it's a 14-day notice. And that applies in all circumstances except the nonpayment of rent, where first nonpayment of rent, you get the statutory 5-day.
Are you getting the nonpayment of rent from J? From,
yes.
Well, then why wouldn't 5Q be?
It would. The 5J notice is not the 704.17 notice.
Right.
It's a notice before
sure.
we get to the statute. Okay?
Which is a benefit to the resident.
Which is a benefit to the resident.
Yes.
And in the nonpayment of rent situation and in the 5Q situation, you don't get this free extra heads up warning letter.
So you're saying then, you're saying that under J, that the nonpayment of rent as well as a violation of 5Q then goes directly to the process, the eviction process.
Yes.
And you're saying that because the Wisconsin eviction process includes the 5-day
yes.
right to cure.
Yes, it goes straight to 9C, it goes straight to the statutory 5-day, and then if there's another violation, it goes to a statutory 14-day.
All right.
And that's how these provisions of the lease can be read consistently with the obligation to follow 704.17. And that's a matter not merely of statute, but it is written into the contract. But that is the procedure we will use to terminate tenancy. Absolutely.
Yes.
Counselor, when I look at 704.17.2b, the terms in here, the verbs, seem to be in the present tense. Commits waste, commits a material violation, breaches any covenant, okay? They don't talk about past terms, but here we're dealing with past criminal activity. And the past criminal activity is alleged to be the use of marijuana on the premises. Why do you think the legislature meant to be to apply at all to past criminal conduct, given those verbs? And secondly, how can you remedy something that's already happened? You cannot unring the bell. So tell me how you remedy past criminal conduct. And now we have smoking of marijuana, which in this day and age could still be a little sympathetic, but because of what goes on in Colorado and elsewhere where the federal law isn't enforced, but the state law permits it. But you could use Judge Fine's opinion for running a numbers business out of the apartment, right? Could do that very easily. It doesn't limit it to marijuana.
Yes, and the...
Okay. So I don't understand. Maybe it's just me, but I don't understand how you can remedy something that's already happened. I just don't know how you can do that. So to me, I have concerns that the statute does not apply to criminal conduct. Tell me why I'm wrong. That would help.
With respect, Your Honor, I think you're wrong because your argument proves too much.
Okay, go ahead and tell me why.
It is not an argument that is limited to criminal activity.
Mine is limited to past.
I know you're limiting your hypothetical, but your argument is broader than your hypothetical.
No, but don't make it broader because I think criminal conduct was never within the contemplation of the legislature when they gave a right
you
to
cure,
remedy. That's
you cure criminal conduct in the same way that you cure any discrete lease breach. And the discrete lease breach can be non-criminal. That bell that gets rung does not have to be a crime bell.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a purely civil annoyance bell. It can be a party that is too loud at 4 in the morning, and that's a breach of the lease.
Mm-hmm.
The logic of your argument says that noisy party breach cannot be cured.
Okay. Okay.
And I think that is not correct. I think the legislature believes that the noisy party bell can be unrung.
Okay.
All right? And we will cure that non-criminal breach of the lease by saying, knock it off.
That's a very good response to my concern.
Okay.
That's a cease and desist. If he says cease and desist, it's okay.
Your response to me is really quite good, because obviously this has been bugging me since I bugged opposing counsel about it as well.
You don't see this as any different, being criminal activity versus a mm-hmm. civil activity? And let me just, so that we don't go too far down this road, we aren't in Colorado, and last time I checked, marijuana use is a violation of federal law. No one here is arguing that this isn't drug-related criminal activity, are they?
Right? That's correct. And, okay. And you're right. When we get to the preemption analysis, and I'll get into that and how the statute lays out how we should really understand L6. Your point's right, and I'll address that. But I was addressing Justice Rogensack's how do we understand 70412 in the context of a street violation?
Now, any violation, non-payment of rent, you can't make the rent paid back a week ago. So the way to cure that is to pay it now.
Correct.
That's different than criminal drug-related activity in federally funded housing.
I will call them status or condition breaches. Okay, non-payment of rent is a condition. It exists as long as you have the rent unpaid. Having an illegal pet is a condition breach. It exists as long as you have the pet. But then we have these discrete conduct breaches that happen, and it has been breached. And the legislature, I think, meant by its language to say the discrete conduct breaches, whether it's criminal or not criminal, can be remedied. We will let that be cured.
So a landlord has no relief other than to go through lengthy notice and eviction proceedings to get a drug-dealing person out of federally funded housing?
Not fair, Your Honor. That is not a fair question. The landlord does have remedies. And the
What's
landlord
the remedy
has
the, to get them
the
out
remedy
now?
That is, it has the remedy that the Wisconsin legislature has given the landlord. If you suspect there is criminal activity, you give a 5-day notice. That is, stop it. Stop it right now. And then if there is any other breach, which could be the same kind of breach, it could be a different breach, there is no right to cure the second one. Now, maybe the second one will be drug-related criminal activity, and maybe it will be something else. But the scenario that
the landlord
is powerless.
There's no way to get them out now is your answer. There's no way.
It's not powerless. The landlord gives the first notice, and if that doesn't stop the activity, as the Wisconsin legislature anticipates, then a second notice terminates the tenancy and there's no power to cure. Now, does a landlord have to go to court to evict a tenant? Yes, if the tenant doesn't vacate, that is the way the legal system works. But that's not an extraordinary burden on the landlord. It's two notices.
It's two letters. What responsibility does a tenant bear to abide by the law as they are in federally funded housing?
They have the duty to abide by the lease.
And, How about the federal law?
The drug-related criminal activity becomes part of the lease, yes. The tenant does not, by residing in public housing, become subject to eviction for late payment of income taxes.
Well, that's not... I suppose if it rises to the level of criminal activity, it might not be in federally funded housing.
That's not grounds to evict.
Well, we're talking drug-related...
Yes.
Last time I
yes.
checked, this
yes, yes,
case
yes.
is
okay.
about when you have a drug... criminal drug-related activity in federally funded housing, what does the landlord have to do to get that person out?
In Wisconsin, the landlord gives a 5-day notice to cease and desist the activity.
And then if I say, I won't smoke any more pot today.
If it stops,
I won't do it for 5 days. And then I can do it again, and then I get a 14-day notice.
And you're out.
Well, okay, so, and then you evict.
Yes, absolutely. That's the rule in Wisconsin. It's two letters. It's two notices. That's the Wisconsin legislature's choice. In 704.17.2, that's what the legislature decided, and that's what the housing authority agreed to in its lease.
One more thing. If we didn't have 704.17.2, would you be making the same argument?
Without 17.2, there's no right to cure.
In other states that don't have this provision, the tenant's out. for
In those states that don't have cure right, and if the landlords follow the eviction procedures that apply in those states, then yes, the tenant's out. The problem here is not that well, was there grounds for termination of the lease? There was.
I understand what you're... I've got your argument. I'm just trying to see how disparate it might be from state to state for federally funded housing.
The HUD must deal... HUD, it's very easy for HUD to deal with uniform contract provisions. It's impossible for HUD to deal with uniform termination and notice and eviction procedures because they are all over the court. And that is, I think, an important part of the congressional objectives and policies. Congress is deferring to states for the methods by which we will go about terminating leases. Congress is saying these nine categories of things that must be in the lease, the 42 U.S.C. 1437 D sub L, of which six and the drug-related criminal activity is one of them, the content of the lease is going to be uniform. But the method by which you terminate a lease is entirely state-dependent. And some states have procedures that are less than even Congress has requires to be in the lease. And that's where we get to the notice provisions that Mr. Heinen's talked about. I don't want to get off of the understanding of the statute and the how do you cure a discrete act breach if justices have other questions. Position is we should just follow 704.12.
Well, my understanding from you on 704.17 is that it applies, 2B applies regardless of what the offense is. When I say offense, I mean it could be
breach.
Yeah, it could be a garbage defense problem, or it could be a pet, or it could be a criminal activity. Everything comes under 704.17 2B from your position.
Yes.
Including the first degree intentional homicide.
Everything.
Yes.
Right. Very hard to cure.
Yes.
How does one cure? How does the tenant cure that?
Goes to prison, so then they're not part of the housing authority anymore.
And then later, they're in front of us.
Yes.
Well, they're still living, apparently.
Yes.
In the housing authority property.
Let me work through the statutory language that then becomes lease language that then becomes federal regulatory language.
Before your time runs out, why don't you talk about preemption? To me, that's a very important issue in deciding this case, and I especially want to know how you get around the Scarborough decision.
Okay. I get around Scarborough decision. I distinguish the Scarborough decision because the cure provisions in both of the two jurisdictions are entirely different. The Scarborough cure provision is a recurring cure provision. Every 30 days, there is a new right to cure. It is not limited, as is Wisconsin's, to one opportunity to cure, and the second violation of any kind in the lease results in a no-cure notice terminating the tenancy. The two sections in the District of Columbia section it's referred to in the Scarborough decision. It's DC Code 42-3505.01B.
Right.
And I encourage you to read the section, but it's not limited to one. Well, and that, it seems to me, if you always have a cure in which the cease and desist cure, which has to be the cure for a discrete violation, if you get as many
opportunities to cease and desist, then you really do have a conflict, real conflict preemption. But that's not Wisconsin's cure statute. So, back to the broad scale of what the preemption analysis should be. The high bar is that sentence that I quoted. We will assume that state law applies and that it is not preempted. When states are exercising these powers, it's a very difficult bar to overcome. It's not a minor annoyance. It's not some distraction. It's not some impediment to the accomplishment of the federal objectives and purposes. It's a very high bar. But now I really want to talk about the importance of defining the federal objectives and purposes. Because it is a misstatement to say, to argue, that the federal objectives and purposes are to evict anybody who uses drugs illegally or engages in any kind of illegal, any kind of drug-related criminal activity. That's not the federal objectives and purposes. And to understand that, we need to look at the entire section that is 1437D, sub L. The entire section says there's nine categories of things that must be in the lease. One of them sets the length of the lease. One of them obligates the housing authority not to have any unreasonable terms in the lease. Sub 5, the one that immediately precedes L6 that has the drug-related criminal activity clause in it, L5 says the housing authority may not evict, may not terminate the lease. Want to get the language right. The lease shall require that the public housing agency may not terminate the tenancy except for serious or repeated violation of the terms and conditions of the lease or for other good cause. It is in that context, L5, severely restricting the grounds on which the housing authority may terminate the tenancy, that one then reads L6 to say, we are by definition declaring, and we are requiring the lease to declare, that drug-related criminal activity is one of those conditions that satisfies L5. That is the context. L6, by definition, satisfies L5 and gives grounds to terminate. But it is L4 that deals with the methods of termination. It is L4 that talks about the notice that is required. And L4 says that the lease shall require that the public housing authority give adequate written and notice of termination of the lease, which shall not be less than, and then the three options are 14 days for non-payment of rent, a reasonable period of time not to exceed 30 days for the L6 criteria, and 30 days unless the state procedure is less. And this leads into Justice Crook's question about how does this fit into the preemption analysis? Because when one looks to the regulations, basically implementing L4 notice provisions and what is the minimum federal notice that must be given, one gets two significant provisions out of the regulations. Number one, the lease must describe the procedures for termination. This lease describes the procedures for termination, and it describes them as 704.17. That's what the lease says, and that's what the federal law requires, the regulations implementing L4. But the next provision that nails down the point is 24 CFR 966.4 L Arabic 3 and then Roman numeral, small 3 I's, which says, a notice to vacate which is required by state or local law may be combined with or run concurrently with a notice of lease termination under this federal provision. The federal notices are not sufficient by themselves. Housing authorities must also comply with state law. That's the federalism. That's the preemption question, is that both of these two provisions for terminating leases coexist, and they coexist very peaceably if the housing authority will just agree to follow the statute, the state statute.
But how does following the state statute guarantee the safety and peace of the other tenants, which is really the focus of the federal law when they say you can't do criminal activity and live in public housing?
Yes, because I think when one gets a notice that says your private recreational use of marijuana that is criminal has been observed, stop it, it stops. I think the effective curtailing of the conduct is not through punishment. It's not through eviction. It's not through evicting people who have made the mistake. It is saying, knock off the conduct. Cease it. And with this opportunity, a 5-day notice written into the statute, I think that's a very powerful mechanism which the housing authority could have, ought to have, used, and this litigation never would have happened because the conduct would have stopped.
But suppose this is a
seller. It would stop because you're talking about a man smoking marijuana or alleged to have been smoking marijuana. It really could be anything.
It could be. And if there's a second occurrence, there's no right to cure.
If there's a second occurrence of first-degree homicide, there's no right. That's where we're going to draw the line here.
Okay.
The second one.
I'm thinking through out loud, but I don't, unless the first-degree homicide disturbs the quiet enjoyment of the occupants of the unit.
The safety.
That's the federal statute. Does a first-degree homicide of somebody who lives 20 miles away become a breach of the lease?
But under your logic, it could be in the apartment. It could be in the dwelling itself. It could be in the hallway of the dwelling.
If it did, then it would breach the lease. Because that would be criminal activity that affects the health and safety.
Just like you acknowledged that the use of the marijuana in this instance provides a breach of the lease, that begs the question that you led me down earlier, quite properly, right to cure.
Yes.
And do we come to a proposition as simple as some things you can't cure? Unlike an ongoing violation of having all the terms here about not having a pet unless it's a single dwelling.
Here's how I would analyze that,
okay.
Your Honor.
Yes.
A murder has occurred in the complex.
Okay.
Right? The conduct there is not simply the act of the murder. The conduct there is the public knowledge that we now have a murderer who is here.
Alleged.
And that is, although the crime is a discreet act.
You had him in prison a few minutes ago, but now it's alleged.
No. But I am making the distinction.
Not you, counsel.
Okay. The crime here is a criminal act that does disturb the peace and quiet enjoyment. Let's assume it will never happen again.
Yep.
Right? But it does disturb the peace and quiet enjoyment of the occupants of the complex. That status breach cannot be cured. The discrete act breach, I did the murder, I smoked the marijuana, I had a loud party, that discrete act breach can be cured. But your murder scenario brings in a different kind of breach because it imposes the breach of the duty for quiet enjoyment. And that breach cannot be cured.
So you're saying that the statute then doesn't apply to status breaches? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that the murder example of Justice Gableman.
Well, and you described it as a status breach. So Justice Rogan-Sachs' question.
No, I'm sorry. I was my bad use of inconsistent use of the terms. The murder creates a condition. The condition is it's not the status of being the criminal. It's the condition imposed on the other tenants who have had their quiet enjoyment breached. And that condition is not ended, I think, by the murderer saying, I'm not going to do it again. That condition may still exist and therefore be uncurable.
That's nice, but what about those citizens, the good citizens in the apartment complex who are upset by illegal drug use because they know it is attracts very unhealthy things to the community? Don't they have a right to be free from the collateral effects of illegal drug use? And not to mention, apparently, the odor of illegal drugs coming through the doorway into the hallway that's shared by the residents?
And
so that's not a status?
That might be that's a different case, I suppose. It's not this case.
These are hard questions, aren't they?
Well, if that conduct creates a breach of quiet enjoyment, and that's what's proved, then I agree with you. And we have been logically consistent.
The other side of the coin is, what if no one's bothered by the murder? What if it was a bad guy who none of the residents liked?
Right, they're glad to get rid of him.
Yeah, no one's bothered.
Then
so,
it would not be a breach of the lease.
So then then we're back to two.
It's the job of the criminal justice system to punish the murderer.
Okay.
Not the job of the landlord to punish the murderer, unless the other tenant's quiet enjoyment is breached.
Okay.
Then it becomes the job of
the
landlord.
When there's a breach of quiet enjoyment, you don't get the 5-day right to cure.
You get the 5-day right to cure, but in the murder scenario, I am suggesting that cannot be in that circumstance. One cannot remove the fear simply by agreeing that I won't do the conduct again.
So when you can't remove the fear, you're saying that's a breach of quiet enjoyment for which the 5-day notice doesn't.
Hypothetically, it might be.
Is that statutorily driven somewhere, or is that coming from language in the statute, or where do you get that?
That's how I would analyze the statute in the first-degree murder scenario that Justice Gableman has posed to me. That it is possible to understand some crimes as being breaches of the lease which create a condition that is not meaningfully cured.
But you think that's what sub 6 says? L6?
L6 says one of the reasons for terminating the lease is criminal activity that
threatens the health, safety, right to peaceful enjoyment of the premises,
yes,
or any drug-related activity.
Yes.
I mean, it basically defines that activity as activity that is a breach of the duty of quiet enjoyment. And you're saying when it's a breach of duty of quiet enjoyment, there's no 5-day right to cure because...
There is a 5-day right to cure, but I think it cannot be cured. That's my point. That's the distinction I'm trying to make.
Fair enough.
Okay?
Thank you.
The right still exists.
Can a noisy party be cured?
I'm sorry?
Can a noisy party be cured?
The discrete act cannot. That's a bell that was rung. And therefore, when the second one happens,
you're saying it comes under the statute.
The noisy party would be a breach of the housing authority's lease, not... It's not an L6 breach, but it's a breach of the lease.
But does it come under what other provision then?
I see my red light is on, and I don't want to sit down if you have a question.
You're not going to get off until the court's finished. Dave?
Do I understand that your view is that the housing authority really has no more authority over a heroin dealer than it does over a marijuana user?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. They have no more authority over a
heroin dealer than they have over a marijuana user.
Your question about the heroin dealer implies that there's more than one deal.
Right.
Right. More than one?
More than one deal. More than one sale. And so, yes, that's a perfectly good example. If the housing authority believes that someone is selling heroin, 5-day notice, knock it off. That ought to stop the heroin.
Wow.
If the heroin dealer makes the rational decision that they would rather be in public housing than selling the heroin, then one would assume that the heroin dealer would stop the conduct. But if it doesn't, the second incident may not be cured. That's the grounds.
Say I was the heroin dealer.
I will assume the hypothetical, Your Honor.
And I've been dealing out of the public housing. And I'll decide I'll deal somewhere else. Does that cure it?
No. This L6, the drug-related criminal activity, applies to your hypothetical heroin dealer that sells off-premises. That dealer can be evicted for the off-premises sale because that's what L6 allows. That's how broad L6 is. It's a very powerful tool. All the housing authority has to do is follow the state statute. It's a very powerful tool. The heroin dealers are out with two letters.
Of course, the people in the public housing authority who are watching what's going on in the authority, I don't suspect you have agents going out to watch what happens across town.
The housing authority gives notices for criminal activity that has happened. Yes. If a 16-year-old child tenant of a household engages in activity that violates the lease, the housing authority will give that notice based on a police report, absolutely positively. So, you know, the housing authority is not limited to knowledge it acquires from its security guard. If it learns that criminal activity that is a violation of the lease has occurred, it can give the 5-day notice, regardless of how they acquired the information. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
The very fact that Congress felt it was important to grant housing authorities the ability to find an innocent tenant vicariously liable for the acts of their household members, guests, and persons under their control underscores the importance of what we're asking this court to do and find that those regulations that were to afford public housing authorities the discretion over whether to evict and not give that discretion to those who violate the lease the first time, that substantive due process right to not be accused of something that someone else does, in fact, had to succumb to a federal regulation that was clearly intended to clean up public housing. And that's the essence of the HUD v. Rucker decision. If that's true, that substantive due process has to step aside, then certainly a procedural landlord-tenant law ought to step aside to a regulation which has the purpose it does over a group of properties that are owned by the federal government who's making the rule. I think it's interesting that Justice Gableman pointed out the facts of a case that is actually cited in the brief, the Ross v. Broadway Towers case out of Tennessee, in which the justice there specifically talked about the fact that if you fail to enforce the lease the first time, what does that say to the other tenants in the development? There seems to be a stark discrepancy between almost the understanding of human nature to think that a simple warning is all that's required to change conduct. That's what's being posited here. And that warning that, again, the discretion is solely vested in the tenant as to whether they'll change the, they'll change their conduct.
Counselor, if you were writing the opinion for the court, would you follow the reasoning in Scarborough?
I certainly would. I certainly would. And I don't see the distinction that the respondent has pointed out as being so significant, because our statute also has multiple cure opportunities, once every 12 months. A second time, if you can argue persuasively that you've remedied before you were served with your second notice, even within the 12-month period. Those are, it is indeed a similar statute that allows for repeated acts of remedying.
Well, then tell me, if you were going to write this, how you would write it in relation to the statute here, 747-707. What do you say? It doesn't apply at all?
No, I would say that to the extent that there are lease violations that do impact the health, safety, and welfare of other tenants, that those lease violations must be reviewed and acted upon as the Public Housing Authority deems appropriate.
And that the state statute of notice doesn't apply.
Just the right to cure, Judge. We still have to give notice because it's a year lease. We have to make sure the notice alleges cause. We have to make a determination as to how much time they will be allowed to stay before they leave. How exigent the circumstances.
They don't get a five-day notice and a year after that.
You do not get a second chance, correct?
That's right.
Or at least it's up to the Housing Authority to decide whether or not the circumstances are such.
Well, the statute doesn't apply.
Correct.
And that goes to anything that deals with health, safety of the other tenants. So if this my favorite dog who went into the elevator and not the freight elevator, and that's a health factor because you've got people in the apartment that are allergic to dogs, that would be, you don't have to give them a five-day notice.
Conceivably, if there's a potential for contagious activity, just the other day we had a case of a person with MRSA coming out of a hospital setting, a clinic setting, with a contagious disease, refused to leave the development, refused to acknowledge, despite the healthcare professional's opinion, that they were indeed contagious with a very dangerous illness.
And that would be come under your rule, and you don't have to follow the five-day, one-year notice issues.
I believe that would be the type of activity that would indeed impact the health, safety, and welfare,
so your ruling
and the right to peaceful enjoyment of the other person.
Right, your ruling is much broader than marijuana, or more broad than a crime. Violation, if it is health and safety, then you don't have to follow the state statute.
I believe it can be expanded beyond that, but I think that the focus of this case is on the very thing that this law was entitled, one strike and you're out.
I understand. The problem is when we write opinions, the language in it that interprets preemption or a state statute will govern other circumstances. That's what I'm really pressing on.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank you, Mr. Heinen, and Mr. Meyer for a very interesting brief and good arguments on the issues raised. And I point out that there were two amicus briefs, and I think I'm right in saying both of them support the petitioner and ask that the Court of Appeals be reversed. That concludes our hearing in 2013 AP 2207, Milwaukee City Housing Authority versus Felton Cobb. I'll be out shortly and speak with the students and anyone else who wishes to. We are in recess until 1:00.